Welcome back, everyone, especially those of you who are online and in a time zone which is almost 12 hours away from here. I'm very glad to have Philip Bond here, and I would like to thank him for accepting our invitation and trekking all the way from Bethesda to here. Philip Bond is an Associate Director for Data Science at the National Institutes of Health, as you can see. Prior to that, he was, I don't know why he did that. He comes here from San Diego. Would anyone come to Washington from San Diego? He said there are lots of exciting things around here, Four Seasons including. Okay. There he was.
One time.
The Associate Chancellor for Innovation at the University of California, San Diego. Philip has authored almost 350 publications, including five books, and one of his papers, I think, has almost 200,000 to 20,000-30,000 citations in the supporting database paper that he co-authored and pioneered. He's been in this area for a long time. Philip not only wears several hats, actually, he was also an entrepreneur at one time in his life. So he was an entrepreneur, an academician, now he's a federal government employee. He's transitioned to several things. He's going to give us his insight of how life turned out to be over the past three decades. Philip.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. Just the way you described it looks like I'm really going downhill fast. Anyway, I guess, yeah, I'm just going to tell you a little about what's going on at the NIH that hopefully relates to this audience. I would encourage you to interrupt me and push back or yell out and complain or whatever you want to do as we go along. It looks like a fairly friendly group, so I can take that. Or I should say that in case you care, the slides are actually on SlideShare, and you can download them. I'm a big open access advocate, and I couldn't possibly not do this without having things online. You heard a little about my background. Let me just say, I did found one of the, or co-founded one of the PLOS journals, which explains in part my love of open access and my bias, I suppose you would argue. I have worked with ontologies for a while. I've worked quite a lot with the Gene Ontology. I was on their advisory group for a while. As part of our work on the Protein Data Bank many years ago, Helen Berman and I and John Westbrook and Keith Wharton-Parr and Paula Fitzgerald and others developed, before anyone heard of ontologies in biology, we developed a pretty rigorous data representation, which still underpins the Protein Data Bank today. I think if you would argue that it's successful, it's, I would say, one of its prime reasons for its success. At least I have some. I'm not speaking to you completely out of a void. I have had some background in areas that presumably interest you. Of course, having said that, I'm going to tell you a huge amount of stuff that I'm doing, but I've only actually been there like 7 weeks, I think. When I was asking Francis Collins, who I report to directly, what's my job description, and his answer was, "You're to change the culture of the NIH." I said, "Okay, what shall I do next week?" Some of my initial rantings about this can be found in a blog that I keep about what's going on here, and that's just a link to some of the vision I had before I started, in case you care about these things. Of course, even though I've only been there a short time, I've actually been thinking about most of the things I'm going to tell you for quite a long time. I couldn't possibly do something without showing a molecule. This is just to emphasize what, I guess, the motivators and the drivers for a lot of the reason you're here and why I'm here. That is, of course, the rapid increase in the amount of data, and I'll say something about that more in a moment. I think the other point to note about this, and this is just one illustration, I could have showed a million different slides for this, and you've probably seen them all. These are protein molecules, and they're molecules from over the years, and they're actually drawn to scale. The point being here is that what we're seeing in all areas of biology is not just numbers, it's complexity. This complexity in this particular field is coming both in the fact that these are supermolecular machines, but also that the experimental techniques that are used to derive this information are, you know, becoming themselves much more complex. So there's a lot of what's called hybrid methods used to actually solve these kinds of structures now. So this is, you know, all just an illustration of why we're here. But another piece of the thing I like is not only why we're here, but what's happening today, but what's happening in the short term. And there are many ways of describing this as well. I actually like this one that estimates there'll be 5,000 gigabytes of data for every single person on the planet by the end of this decade. And that's what we should be planning for right now. And that, in terms of federal agencies, what we're, you know, effectively confronting. And I have to say that for my brief stint at the NIH, we're completely unprepared for it in many ways. And I'll try and illustrate that a little more as we go along. But of course, it also, out of adversity, there's also opportunity. So there are many things that could happen around this data. There are many, you know, estimates of what is coming down the pipe, and I actually just, I mean, some would argue, and I would go along with it, that we're at this sort of inflection point, that in this potential exponential growth, we're sort of this inflection point, and these folks from MIT, I mean, you may have seen this book, it's one of a number of this kind of genre of books. This is, you know, this is the next industrial revolution. And they would argue that we are on this cusp, and the evidence they show for it is that some things are happening much faster than anyone anticipated. So the idea of Google Car, the idea of processing in real time large amounts of sensor information to automatically drive a car, most people thought that would not happen in this shorter time, and yet it's quite clear that it works pretty well. There are other examples, of course. Ways I like particularly because that's like real-time processing of social network data to define how you should drive through traffic. And you can, you know, digest all of that in real time. And that wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for all of the, you know, the Moore's Law and everything else that goes with it. So the argument is that we're at the bottom of this upward curve and some really dramatic things are going to happen in the next few years. And we can, you know, no one's pushing that right yet, but we could debate that. I would say that, and so this was sort of appreciated a while back at the NIH, and in fact there was a working group formed that reported directly to the director of NIH to actually look at what needed to be done. And that actually then led to my appointment. It also led to an initiative that's called BD2K, which is the Big Data to Knowledge initiative that the NIH has going. And my budget for that this year is $25 million, and the next year it's $100 million, and the year after that it's $100 million. And this comes from the NIH Common Fund, so it's actually money taken away from all of the individual institutes and centers of the NIH, all 27 of them. And, you know, I have to convince them over a period of time that we're doing good things with this money and that they should keep on giving it. But for the time being, there's things to be done. And really, out of this working group report, there was sort of like four different sort of aspects. Facilitate, all fairly obvious at this coarse grain level, but broad use, analysis tools, enhancing training, and establishing centers of excellence. That's what came out of this report. I'm actually looking at things a little differently from this, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But that then led to a series of processes that are either out the door or will very soon be out the door. So, for example, there is the notion of a data discovery index, where it will be an index of data sets, and I'll say more about that towards the end. That's currently under review, and so there will be a consortium that develops such an index. What I hope will come from that is the idea that this becomes not only a registration point for data sets, but also, in a sense, at some level, a Yelp for data sets, so that you'll be able to go there, you'll be able to see commentary on data sets if there is any such made. You'll actually be able to add your own commentary to it, and you'll actually be able to see how frequently such metrics are very important here, how frequently such data sets are used. And that's all going to come out of the Data Discovery Index. There are 6 to 8 data centers that potentially will be awarded. Those are currently under review, and those are they cover different areas ranging from centers that are, these are not domain specific, these are really more data specific. So they could focus on things such as compression, different types of what the NIH calls data wrangling, which includes all types of analysis and so forth, and visualization and dissemination. And I'm already pretty keen, and I'll say it here, that this is not going to be a set of initiatives which I've seen way too much in the past from a number of funding agencies, where centers are formed and they take the money and they run and they do what they like. What we're going to see here is with a situation where we're actually going, there's going to be significant contributions towards a national infrastructure. And there are other, this isn't the only effort towards a national infrastructure. Such a thing is going on at the NSF and so forth. So I think it's very important that the agencies really communicate and think about working together on some of these things. And we could discuss that. Clearly training. When I left San Diego, not just in biomedical research, but in my role as in innovation, I was made aware that there were 4,500 jobs just in the San Diego region that could not be filled because there weren't the data scientists to fill them. UCSD and the surrounding institutions were not training people, enough people, to do this. That's a pretty serious problem. And so there are RFAs out there to start to begin to address that situation, and there are actually grants under review already. There's a software index. There's a workshop about that in May. Why we're separating data and the software is another. This predates my arrival. It wouldn't have happened if I'd have been there when this happened, but in any case. So it's the same idea. It's essentially an effort towards cataloging existing software that's out there and offering services around that software in terms of, you know, things like ratings and so forth. And then there's under development is what will become an RFA for a catalog of standards, which certainly pertains to this audience, presumably. And that's still under development. And that will then lead to a workshop and other things, which I would encourage you to keep an eye on and look out for. So I would say what I just told you is just the beginning. So these are things, activities that are already going on. So I've just been now making some early, for me at least, early observations which are going to influence what happens going forward. And I want to tell you what they are and see what you think about them. So I would say one of my early observations is we don't actually know very much about the data we already have, let alone all this effort that's going into you know, the big so-called big data initiatives. We don't know much about the data we already have. And I, as someone who maintained data source resources until about 2 months ago, you know, I can speak to this in terms of what the federal agencies actually asked us to do. I mean, basically what they want to know is they want to know, well, how many users do you have, where are they, and how much data gets downloaded, you know, every month. Well, that's not really saying much about really how the data is used. That's really a cursory thing. And here's an example that illustrates why we need to do more. In the top right-hand corner there is a graph of from the CDC, which shows accumulated cases of H1N1 during the pandemic of 2009. On the bottom, on these two graphs, are accesses to specific data objects. In this case, they happen to be structures within the PDB, but let's just call them data objects, and how they were accessed during that same period. And what you see is that there's some level of correlation. So it's not surprising that when something like this happens, people go to look at the data associated with these kinds of events. what was intriguing to me was whether this could actually be used as a leading indicator. In other words, if you look to because the way CDC reports is quite slow in getting all that data together and getting it out there. Could we see things above the noise that were reflective of what was happening in the community as it was happening? I mean, as far as I'm aware, most of the data sources, certainly in the biomedical sciences, don't even think about doing things like this. So we're not making good use of how our data is used, which to me is rather ironic because it strikes me that many companies almost make their living on actually understanding how people are using their data and their information. So another example, which is one I really liked, and I presented to the advisory board, some of the people who probably sit in this room periodically, that for the PDB of what we should be doing, and it was a simple thing. It's if, and it's exactly akin to what goes on at Amazon and Netflix, right? If there is a data object, let's call it a protein structure, if an IP address looks at a protein structure, and then the same IP address looks at data object B, A and B, and then that happens again and again, the chances are when the next user comes along, if they're looking at B, they probably should look at A because there's an association between them. No one, even though this is big business to many companies, it's not something we do in science at all that I'm aware of. I've said that. I've had pushback. People say to me, actually one instance is people say, oh, we're actually doing this. But clearly there's not enough of analyzing. We don't have good metrics, and we're not doing good measurements on the data we already have. And this is critical when you start wanting to start looking at sustainability because, you know, if you don't know what you've got already, how are you going to figure out what you can sustain going forward? A question. I love it. Yes.
Brandon Neiman, Semantic Community. Wednesday, NIST is starting a group on data science metrics. I'll try to get a handle on this.
I'm sorry?
Wednesday, NIST is starting a new group on data science metrics to get a handle on this.
Yeah, I mean, there is activities now, too, within the NIH to try and do this. And I think, again, this will be a great opportunity for some of the agencies to get together and figure out and look at what they're actually both proposing to do. I mean, at the NIH, there's, and this is true everywhere, what's obviously happening is that there's a large number of data resources coming to the trough or back to the trough to be funded, and it's eating an increasing amount of the total R&D budget. And, you know, this, if you make some projections about what this means, it's fundamentally a very serious problem if it persists at its current rate. So, you know, the question then comes, well, what do you keep and what do you not keep? That's where these sorts of metrics become, you know, very important. So, yes, it's great. I mean, I think we should all be looking this together and we should be approaching this sustainability problem together. There was actually a meeting about this just last Friday here in Washington that was convened by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. In some ways, it's a bit depressing that it takes an outside third-party foundation to bring the feds together to do this. Of course, I'm blaming myself now. I'm now one of them. Another thing I've noticed is, which is even more amazing to me, is that there are all these directives now. So there's the OSTP directive for data sharing. So in some senses, this describes why we need to share data. I mean, it's obviously a good thing anyway. But what I found in sort of poking around is there hasn't been enough thought about the how. How, you know, if there's suddenly these requirements that data generated by public money needs to be in the public domain, where's it going to go? Now, certainly there are a lot of data that fits into existing data resources. And, you know, those resources will just continue to grow. But there's a lot of things that don't actually fit into those criteria. What happens to that information if there's now a demand for it to be made available? It wasn't very thoughtful, I think, if I dare say, of the White House to essentially say, well, you've got to make the data available, but we're not giving you any more money to do this. It's got to come out of your existing budgets. So clearly, we got some interesting aspects of this. So, you know, this just essentially says what I just described. And a lot of this I'm talking about is what I would call the long tail of science. It's all of that data that really doesn't quite fit anywhere but now needs to have a home. So one of the things we've been moving towards at the NIH that I've been pushing on is the idea of creating a data commons. This effectively is a sandbox. At its simplest incarnation, this would be a Dropbox for, it says NIH investigators, but there's already been some interest from the pharma industry in this, and I don't see why it should actually be restricted in that way. And it'll probably be in the cloud. We can argue all these definitions. And you can imagine all sorts of interesting things happening with this, all right? At its very simplest incarnation, it is nothing more than a Dropbox. But I think if for larger amounts of information, the majority of lab bench scientists or lab scientists, myself included, would relish having this available because I don't have something like this available in my own institution or elsewhere. So that would be, that would be at its very simplest arc incarnation. And of course, if this data has to be available, that's available, there's already a certain stick there. So you could actually apply that stick a little. So you can, in this drag and drop mode, you can actually request some provenance associated with that data beyond, typically what might be actually requested, say, in Dropbox, which is really just access control. So that's the next layer. And you can begin to add layers on top of this. So the thing that excites David Littman at NCBI and I about this is, it becomes a sandbox so that people can begin to write applications on top of this. So a drag and drop might lead to, for an identified data type, it might lead to some level of validation or authentication of that data to see whether it conforms to an existing standard. And the level at which it does would then be written into a metadata file, which is available in the commons with the data itself. And, of course, people can then look at that. And then some of that data will migrate up into existing resources kept at NCBI or elsewhere, but that would be the next step. And then, of course, the pipe dream is the idea that once all this data is sitting there, you can start munging it, looking for commonalities. So if you know about how the NIH operates, it's essentially 27 different silos, and the data is kept very much independently. So, which doesn't actually make sense, particularly in this day and age of complex diseases, where data in one institute has value in another. There's no question about that, around two different diseases, for example. So you could imagine a day when you have a set of researchers working and they're depositing some data in the commons, and it has a whole bunch of, it's about a set of genes that are overexpressed in some pulmonary disease. Well, over here in the National Cancer Institute, there's a group of investigators running a cohort of patient information where they see in prostate cancer, they see downregulation in a set of genes. Now, there's overlap within those two gene sets. And if this happens if this is prominent in these investigators' individual data streams, then maybe they should be made aware of each other that they've been looking at the same genes for different purposes. So this kind of automatic, finding correlations between things could have value. It's a dream, okay? But I like to dream. To do all of this, you've got to have an associated business model. And we're working through different scenarios with Google, AWS, and folks as to how this might be sustainable in the longer term and how big and how it could grow. Question?
Yes. Well, I like what you're saying. What I have word ontology in your description. And it seems to me that ontology gives you the superstructure where the stuff comes in, you know where to file it, and someone else knows how the catalogs to make them retrieve it. You can keep adjusting the ontology as you learn more about all these phenomena. Am I missing something?
No. I mean, I think, first of all, I think what you're going to see in there is a total mixed bag, all right? But I think what you can do is already a good number of the data types that will be kept in here would have ontologies associated with them. And that's what I meant by wanting to apply that ontology to what's actually put in there. So if you can then map what's in a data file to what the ontological description is and actually describe where there are inadequacies, that's useful information to someone who wants to come and look at that file, because that file will be already registered in the data catalog. So people will be able to look at that file and other related files, and if they see one of them of different data sets, but, you know, some relationship or some similarity, but they see one of them is conformant to this ontology, that's the one I would choose. That will then, the idea is that would then drive more use to ontologies, because if suddenly we now have data citations and suddenly it's seen that your competitor down the corridor is getting more data citations than you're getting because their data is in better shape, it will drive things in the right direction. Sorry, that was an awful lie. I started talking about reward systems, and I haven't even got to that yet. But am I making sense?
Yes. It just strikes me, if you have an evolving, part of your effort is explicit evolving of the ontology of all of it, then
right.
That will probably be more important than the Dropbox or the data that you're pouring into it.
Absolutely. And, in fact, yeah, I mean, obviously all of this is dynamic, so the ontologies are going to grow as well. But you could... I mean, I hadn't even thought about this before until now, but it's another dream. You know, and I mean, there are efforts at automatic ontology recognition and building, right? But so you could imagine a whole set of data files that conform, that are a certain type, of which there is already an ontology, but repeatedly the same elements appear in these data, but they're not in the ontology. That would tell someone, hey, maybe we ought to improve the ontology. I like it. I'll add it to my slide. I'll steal your idea. Okay.
May I interrupt? If anyone wants to ask a question, please use the microphone. Otherwise, people on the remote lines will not hear anything.
Okay. So the third observation I had is on day one at the NIH, I wrote a note to a few of the high-ranking individuals whose names I shall not mention. And so I've Googled, and I can't find anything that relates to an NIH plan for data sustainability. And they said, well, that's not surprising. We don't have one. this is a big thing. I've already harped on it to some extent, but this is really going to be an amazing driver. And I think sustaining things comes in different forms. Let me just give you a couple of examples. And I've got plenty of problems here, but I also have some solutions, all right? So one of the things that has happened to me is it's what I call the Google bus, okay? So before I left San Diego, Google does not have an office in San Diego, but they have an office in Irvine. So what I found is over time, half of my lab ended up going to work every day on the Google bus. It could have been the Bourne Lab bus. I mean, it got to be... you know, ridiculous, because I could not keep these people at the university. These are very good data scientists for the most part. And, you know, for some of them it was money, and, you know, there's no way that the university is ever going to compete with that. But for others, it was being identified as a scholar. And I would argue that the current traditional academic environment does not well recognize scientists, data scientists as scholars. And I think, you know, I speak with passion about this because many moons ago I was one of those people. And I think we actually got a pretty raw deal. And what's interesting in my role before I left as an administrator is that there was growing concern about this because, you know, partly because they care, but partly because it turns out more and more these are the people who are bringing in the indirect money into the university. So, you know, you don't want them leaving to go and work for Google, particularly, and the NIH doesn't want them to go and work for Google when, you know, unless we're doing something together, because we spent a lot of money training some of them, or many of them. So these are sort of issues of sustainability around people, which I think we really need to test up with. And Dan Katz and I and others have been, and Ed Seidel have been having discussions about how we might help address this situation. One of the ideas is, which will happen, I think, is to have a workshop where we bring in high-level university vice chancellors of research and really highlight to them the value that these people are bringing to the institution. And, you know, I think if this is done under the auspices of the federal agencies, these folks will actually show up. Other things I've noticed about, you know, related to data is that data is always treated equally, even though data actually has different levels of maturity. You know, there's all sorts of different aspects to it. But, you know, so these are issues. The way we review data resources at the NIH is suboptimal. I won't go into the reasons for that, because that's a whole lecture in itself. But these are all things that need to be looked at. So these are just some problems. So what are the solutions to this around sustainability? Well, I think, first of all, right now the individual institutes fund these things, but a lot of this stuff should probably be done centrally, and there should be a central oversight, a standing review panel that looks at this and really tries to help foster best practices, because we don't, at least at the NIH, we don't quite often, that's not what happens. And it's not surprising if you think about the history of how many of these resources come about. It's essentially one or more investigators who are very passionate about some data. And over time, they keep building this data, building it, and sooner or later, other people want to access it and use it. So they just say, oh, let's write to the NSF and get a database grant. All right? And quite often when they do that, what they actually put forth is something where the data part of it is really well done, but the data management part of it is often suboptimal. And there's not best practices that are put in place to address that issue. Another issue that just came up at this meeting last Friday, it was actually from Eric Green, who's the head of the Human Genome Institute, NIH, was the idea of using a 50% model. So what that means is you say, okay, we're going to give you this award to maintain your database. But when this award runs out in 3, 4, 5 years, we're only going to give you 50% of the money in the next round, assuming you're successful. So that means you've really got 3, 4, 5 years to figure out a sustainability model, a business model, to maintain this data. I mean, this sounds harsh, but I would say these are the realities of the new world. So if you've got better ideas for sustaining this stuff, I'd love to hear them, because there's plenty of problems, but not that many ideas. There's various kinds of freemium models, bringing in foundations, interactions with the private sector, the role of institutional repositories and all of this, and so forth. So there are, you know, I think, again, the metric reporting, which we already touched on. So these are all, potential possibilities, and I know it's not quite probably the focus of this meeting, but I think, if you want to work in ontologies, you want to have some data to build ontologies around. So it's worth thinking about. I already mentioned a bit about training, but it's clear that at least what goes on at the NIH is the training is rather spotty. So in other words, there are some things that are taught time and time again by different institutes, and there's large areas of data science where no one's teaching anything. And so we're looking to sort of at least address some of this. And one of the thoughts I've had, and it'd be lovely to do this as an interagency thing, because a lot of this is basic data science teaching, is to establish some training at one or more training centers where people actually come and they do hands-on stuff for 2 or 3 weeks. In my world, the Cold Spring Harbor do these kinds of things, and they're very successful. Investigators go back. You know, it's graduate student, postdocs, faculty, and they go back to their institutions and, they actually begin to apply what they learn at these heavy-duty hands-on courses. So that's just something we've been thinking about and we'll probably likely put into place. Reproducibility, of course, which ties into the idea of having standards and ontologies, this is a big thing now that's on, of course, everybody's mind. And it comes about because, you can go into the newspaper and you can read, that it's been reported that 70-plus percent of all seminal studies in cancer research are not reproducible. Well, if you're a congressman reading that in the newspaper in the morning and you're responsible for going to the Appropriations Committee to give NCI $4.5 billion a year, you say, why are we giving you money if you can't even reproduce what's going on there? So, you know, these things are going to come back to haunt us, I think. And, you know, so the idea of doing better with respect to reproducibility is, you know, important. And that's why, you know, along the lines of what we've been discussing, the idea of having good representation is important, but it's more than that. So these are these kind of things that come up. And I actually looked at this in my own lab. So I actually published a paper recently which said I cannot reproduce the work from my own lab. And I was proud to publish this paper, right? Because I know that I am not alone. I mean, and it wasn't that I couldn't reproduce. It was that I could not reproduce easily. Right? And the truth of the matter is any graduate student who comes into a lab, when they try and pick up a piece of work that was done by a student that's already left, will testify, yes, this is not straightforward. I mean, you can argue that there's a learning piece to this, that, you know, but at the same time, it shouldn't be this difficult. And the question we asked ourselves is actually, how difficult is it? And so we quantified every step. So we took a piece of research that had data sets, software, scripts, you know, all of this. It was a purely in silico piece of work and a published paper. And then we gave it to people of different skill sets in this field and asked them to reproduce the work. And, of course, you know, it's the old story. Four authors on a paper, two have left the lab, including the first author who did most of the work. You know, you call her up and she says, well, I think that, yeah, you'll find those scripts. It's still sitting on that computer in the corner of the room. You know, this is it. This is what we're doing. This is life, right? And then, you know, and then they ask me, and of course I'm the PI on the thing, and, you know, I haven't the faintest idea where anything is. I mean, it's, you know. So it took, this is just the experiment you can read about. It was done by putting this into a workflow system, in collaboration with Daniel Garrigo, who's, actually was working for Elsevier at the time. And, blanking, it's terrible, Yolanda Gill from USC. We used her workflow system, and this, I won't go into it. What was interesting in doing all of this, what automatically falls out of this, is a figure which I would call should be figure one in the materials and methods section of almost any paper, right? Because it actually describes in one pictorial exactly what the experiment did. And, you know, this is, to me, this is stuff that should happen routinely. It took 280 hours for, you know, someone who was knowledgeable but not an expert to actually reproduce this piece of work, which seems to me, you know, we could do much better. We broke down where all the bottlenecks were. Anyway, we should be doing better. So I would say these, what I've told you is a whole set of issues, but what are the solutions? And I've sort of, in my head at least, I cast the solution into what I call the digital enterprise. Any institution is a candidate to be a digital enterprise. Some already are, I suppose. I haven't actually come across any who would seem to fill that to my satisfaction anyway. But so what does that mean? Well, first of all, essentially everything we do in certainly an academic institution or at the NIH or the NSF at some point now is in digital form. So that forms a set of digital assets. And if you think about what that's like in a medical center setting, for example, you've got data sets, papers, software, lab notes, and you've also got educational materials and everything else. And you could argue that at some point, you know, publishing of that material is really just changing access control. Okay, there's review as well, but, you know. And then, of course, the idea is that digital assets are interoperable across the enterprise. So I made up, this was actually published a little while ago, and I actually have another one I made up for the NIH. But I mean, and I'm not going to, don't expect you to read all this. If you care, you could look at it. But I just want to illustrate a point that was a point I was making at UCSD before I left, and it's a point that I'm now making at NIH, and it, on a different scale. 30 times the scale, I guess, if you want to talk about research dollars in billions. But really, what there is advantages potentially to be had in this, because what exists right now is silos. So you could say all of the any educational materials that an institution has and that are online are essentially siloed from everything else. The research data is all over the place, but it's certainly siloed. It's siloed from each other, but it's also siloed from the other forms of data. The administrative data, where all the grants are kept, all everything that's going on, that's a separate silo. And then if you're a medical center, all the clinical data is yet another silo. So if just some very simple interoperations between those silos can buy you so much. So I just sit there on a rainy Sunday afternoon, which, of course, in San Diego was rarely, but now it happens to me every weekend, thinking about these things. So, these like little scenarios. So one of them, I've just been working with students, one or two I feel like child prodigies. They're just amazing. And when I'm doing that, I'm thinking that they're coming as undergraduates to universities and taking courses. And increasingly, those courses are online, and they get graded automatically online. So if I have a student who's exceptional in a piece of the course, a professor who teaches or does research around that area that's in the course, unless he or she is the one teaching that course, they will never discover that student. It's like light years away. Well, why shouldn't that happen automatically? All it requires is the fact that this student did very well to be identified and to have a decent profile, which, by the way, we don't have in almost – it's changing now. We don't have almost in any university for those people. What we have, if I wanted to find out what people were doing at UCSD, I would Google them. Well, that doesn't tell me, that doesn't give me an in-depth view of what that person does. And so I would make that connection. Then that professor would then approach that student and say, hey, you did really well on this. You want to come and do an internship in my lab? And then there's a whole scenario about, I may end up winning Nobel Prizes and all that kind of stuff. But, you get the idea, right? And those kinds of connections, we should be making them every day, and we don't. Yeah.
Is there not a problem with privacy of linking all of these sources? In that example where, you were looking at it from the perspective of the good, finding the correct students, but I could imagine that you could do like the other way around of determining the very bad student to be axed from the courses or the one that you're not paying attention to.
Well, that's kind of what we do all the time anyway, isn't it? I mean, But you're right. There are these sorts of concerns. But in this particular instance, you don't actually, for example, have to reveal to the professor who the student is. You could, for example, the student could be the one to take the impetus, saying, because essentially the professor is that information is already known. And but most students are not going to be concerned that they reveal that they did extremely well in a course. But it's true when they do badly. And, there are these kinds of downsides obviously exist in, any data type you talk about. You start getting into clinical data, you're in a whole different, you're into the issues you're raising in droves. But, I think you have to sort of take every data type and every situation as it comes and figure out how to manage it. In some cases, you have to figure out how to regulate it because you probably won't be able to manage it. Because the technology will just run away with it. But anyway, we can talk about that. Here's just another example from the NIH sort of, and I won't bore it. So I guess where I'm looking, yeah. Yes, sorry, you have to use the mic.
Just to add to your point, Harvard has a framework called Harvard Research Profiles, which actually connects research scholars across the topics of interest when you just upload their profile into the institution framework, so you can automatically connect to your similar kind of research group. They don't exactly involve students, but they only, I think, involves the professors or associate faculty.
No, I mean, these systems are beginning. There are others as well, and that's a good one. We've been experimenting with these before I left UCSD. So it's clear. And then, I bring that. So then I'm thinking, well, okay, now I have, I'm in an institution where I have some sticks. So, you know, I can begin to use that. First of all, having a profile system, ultimately, its value is only going to be if the faculty member actively participates and keeps that as the master copy of their scholarly life, right? But to do that, you've got to incentivize them. So, you know, one way to incentivize them is that that's the system you use for promotion files. I mean, as you know, we spend an enormous amount of time cutting and pasting things into different formats to meet different criteria, you know. And I think what's happening with SciCV that's going on at NIH and NSF and other places to standardize the bibliographic format, this is a wonderful development, and that needs to be pervasive within the university environment as well, so we create much more seamless interoperability against, sorry, I've hardly mentioned the word ontology at all, against, you know, standard ontologies for describing scholars.
Steve,
this is much more fun than me rambling on. But, yeah.
Steve Ray, CMU. I was reminded when the privacy question came up, I just on the 26th, which is what, 2 days ago, read a New York Times article about this startup called InBloom, which was building these linked profiles of students of the courses they took, $100 million spent on the company, crushed because of opposition of privacy concern by parents. I mean, it was exactly the same vision you were talking about of being able to help students. So I think this privacy issue is indeed something we can't just
shove under the rug.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have a good answer to that. What I would say is I would quote something like PCORI, which is actually a patient network that's effectively doing this, where they're trying to build patient large, you know, million patient cohorts to do clinical trial studies in ways that are much faster than studies that are currently done and much less expensive. And, you know, again, you run into this problem, but it's a question of balance. I mean, do people feel that this contributes to their healthcare in ways that it's worth, you know, at least taking that risk? And it's problematic. You know, I think each one of these is going to find its own balance. And
question: in your vision here, is there a notion of symmetry involved in information sharing among the parties?
Yeah. I do structural biology. Symmetry is my middle name. No, I mean, yes. That first of all.
Well, then couldn't an asymmetry alleviate some of the security issues or the privacy issues?
Well, I think that was what I was alluding to before, where maybe you're thinking of something different. I'm not understanding you correctly. But the idea that, you know, the professor's profile is already public, so the student should be pointed to that professor, which they probably wouldn't know otherwise when they do well on that course. But the professor is not necessarily pointed to the student unless the student wants that to be released. Is that what you mean by asymmetry? Okay.
It may also be, you know, partly a cultural acclimation issue. I mean, what strikes me most about what you've described here is that it is a formalization of what happens informally at small colleges, right? Having gone to one, a tiny little college myself, it was routine to bright students or students who stood out in one area. The faculty talked, and they talked about what students were impressing them at the time, and faculty would approach students and say, "Hey, I'm doing this small seminar, and I'd love it if you would take it, and or assist teaching or something." This would happen all the time, and the students found that to be, you know, in immensely valuable part of their education and something that brought them to new areas. I see something like this. If you have this kind of opt-in capability from the student side, I think overwhelmingly once people got used to the idea that they were taking.
I mean, I think, you know, opting in is, you know, it's going to apply in lots of different contexts. I mean, right now people opt into a clinical trial for a specific, generally speaking, for a specific purpose. But more and more patients are clearly willing to opt in, provided there's some, measure of the identification, for that data to be used however the researchers think. And others won't. But, you're going to get way bigger and less expensive cohorts of patients than we have today for many different things. Economics is just going to drive all of this in the end, I think. But it's not to say, as you're pointing out rightly so, dashing my hopes of an early victory that this is going to happen overnight. But, things will move forward. Okay, so those are the... So I think to sort of end off, I would say that I think, you've got to consider this not just as elements of data in this, but it's really about the complete research life cycle, which, of course, has this all these different pieces, right? Ideas come, you generate hypotheses from ideas, you conduct experiments to test those hypotheses, that generates data which you analyze and you comprehend from those results, and then, of course, you publish it, and then you whip that around to write a grant so you can actually develop more ideas. So, and then we have resources that support that research life cycle. Some of them have been around effectively unchanged for a long time, which is a bit depressing. Authoring tools, most people still author in probably not this audience, but for us mere mortals in things like Word. That's not necessarily the best environment for this kind of thing. Lab notebooks have never, in my experience, we've never really had success with lab notebooks. And then suddenly Evernote comes along, and everyone in my lab's using that because it's dead simple and we get lots of, and it's people using it around the table, So there are these things happening, but I think one of the problems is that they kind of plug into the pipeline, but they don't plug into each other. So there's very little interoperability between any of these things. And I think that is where, I could see really improvements and massive change being made. And then, of course, there's sort of communities and a whole series of things on the other side of this that isn't really the technologies that that come into play, the emergence of communities. I'm very intrigued by how communities emerge and grow and flourish and do things in some instances, in other cases just die on the vine. And then within that mix, you've got, things like GitHub, which are clearly very successful. But we can clearly do a lot better with some of these things. And in my own absolutely analytical way, I actually tried to evaluate these things, which is what I've done here. So if you have a Swiss flag, it means this is doing okay, right? It's a kind of a neutral thing. If you have clapping hands, I'd say it's actually doing well on average. If you've got skull and crossbones, then there's definitely room for improvement. This has absolutely no meaning whatsoever, except I like doing it. But this is sort of, in my mind, where we want to be going. And, the next step for my way of thinking about doing this, and this is almost precursive to some of the things that have already gone out of the door as RFAs at NIH, is we've really got to get a handle on the notion of research objects. I mean, it's quite stunning that the publishing industry could all, as cutthroat as they are with each other, could all come together and agree to use digital object identifiers. We should at least be able to come together and use research object identifiers and then gradually build on that so we can begin to identify all of these pieces. I had a dream the other night. I dreamt that everything that I did had a research object identifier associated with it. That then became a string, a regular expression, which I then could immediately compare to other regular expressions, and I could see what research I'd done, how similar or different it was to someone else's. It was only a dream. But anyway, but that seems to me the kind of next type of thing we should be doing. And then the other thing that we're really pushing on, well, many things actually, but just this week, is data metrics, because, I think we must begin to measure better how we're using the data that's coming now, and we already have. So which will then drive some changes in the reward system, I hope. So don't hesitate to email me if you want to push back or you have questions or anything like that. And I appreciate the dialogue, and let's have a bit more. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Philip. And we have time for questions. And before that, let me wave my hat as the moderator here and ask the first question. You talked about putting all those millions of dollars into developing data scientists. Do you think you'll have a problem in the future where we have a data scientist, saturation problem? DSSP is called data scientist saturation problem, where you have all these people are there in the field, and they got to find them employment, I guess.
Well, yeah, maybe, I suppose. If we get to that point, I suppose a lot of things going to happen between now and then for us to get there, and that a lot of good things would happen on the way. So, markets are self-adjusting, and these people get retrained and all the rest of it, and there's actually a lot of discussion in that book about the Second Industrial Revolution, about the perturbation that these kinds of things have on society and jobs and so on. But it happened during the Industrial Revolution. It will happen again. Maybe this data thing will be the third revolution or whatever at some point. One step at a time. I think it's going to be a while before we get to that problem.
Gary?
Yes. RDA was mentioned this morning by a keynote speaker, issue of data types was mentioned by you, and I just wanted to point out that as part of RDA, there are work groups, and one of which is developing a data type registry, and they're also working in this PID, persistent ID area, so that's something that might be leveraged in the future.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's true, I didn't make that connection, but, gave a keynote at the first RDA meeting, and I talked to Fran Berman a lot, and other people, of course, that are associated with it. And I'm pleased to see that's really seems to be getting some traction and taking off. These are important developments, and it sort of comes back to these notions of communities. And one of the things I've observed is that community, that's a little different. I mean, that's got some pretty significant funding. But there are lots of efforts, and you can imagine this around ontologies for sure, where a group of people get together because they're passionate about this and they start to do it, but their strength is actually coming up with the ontology, not the organization or some aspect or outreach or something associated with it. And yet a small amount of money that would actually really help these communities sort of get to the next level and be successful. And frankly, I mean, I've been in this situation a couple of times, and I've always looked at NIH, NSF primarily, and never found a means by which that small amount could be found. And yet, foundations like Doris Duke, Gordon Betty Moore, Sloan Foundation have actually supported me in these kinds of things. So one of the things, I think it doesn't take RDA or Qantas money necessarily, but, small amounts of money can really help these things. Right? Just so that wasn't your question, but it made me think about that. But, I think it is really important that we should all try and come together on these things as much as possible. And, I think it would be, so if you take that to how this will work, first of all, Fran was very much involved in the Data Discovery Index. She chaired the workshop that sort of led to it. So I think what we'll see when that's awarded, I mean, one, it's going to be, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but it may end up being a contract, in which case, if that happens, there'll be quite some significant oversight. And that's an opportunity to say, okay, you folks have got to go over and start working with RDA on this because they're already doing this. They've done this and that. I mean, I'm getting away from this. It's not invented here. It's got to happen.
One small follow-up, if I could, on that is that when you're thinking about data types, you start to think about hierarchies of types, but there are inadequate semantics often in those taxonomies. And so as you're doing that work, it's important to start thinking about including some semantics through things like ontological schemas.
Yeah. I would agree with that. On the other hand, I was involved in the thing that we did in structural biology. I think it was too complex. So it's finding that balance. But certainly, yeah, this is important.
We have two questions, Brent and Todd. So then
I thought it was an excellent talk, one comment, and then one question. Francis Collins gave an excellent presentation on this very thing at the TEDMED conference last year. And you might want to show the video or include a link of that. Second thing is, last year I was asked by congressional staff working on the Data Act what I would recommend be done. And this is what I recommended, and I think you're moving in that direction. I'd like to get your comment on. It was to have a chief data officer for the government and for every agency that would lead a team of data scientists that would work on significant scientific and business problems with data and document the results so that you have a permanent link, hopefully, to how the data was collected, where it's stored, and what are its results. And so they liked that idea, and they suggested that I show them how that could be done. So we have a community of about 4,000 data scientists in the D.C. area that participate in regular meetups. And part of that I lead, we have about 180 people that are working with big data. And we actually get teams of data scientists to work with data sets and present the results answering those three questions so that it is reproducible, like Francis Collins suggested at TEDMED last year. So you're moving in that direction. You are the chief data officer. You just need teams of data scientists that work on very high-priority data sets and document the results and share them with others.
Well, I'd really appreciate if you would contact me offline so I can follow up with this because, yeah, I mean, this has to be crowdsourced. You know, these are huge needs. And everybody who wants to, all of that energy has to be corralled into things that are going to actually work. I mean, all I can do with a small team is essentially, direct traffic. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Okay. Yeah. So I think last question, Todd, because we need to move on.
If you can ask the question quickly.
I doubt it.
Well, if not, I'll talk to you later. If you could expand more on what your notion of a research object is or might be and how that may or may not compare to a notion Leibniz may have had that's similar, at least it sounds similar to me.
No, I mean, they are. This has come up in different contexts, and I don't claim to, essentially what it is it's something that you choose to define. It could be some data, could be a piece of software, but it's something that you identify uniquely, and it's something that has provenance. And it's something that is likely to have some level of metadata beyond provenance associated with it. That's probably the extent of my thinking on what that should be. And one of the thoughts I've had, because in that previous slide, this seems to me to be almost a prerequisite next step to anything, is really to convene people to actually come and help sort of really specify what this should be. Because then, my goal is that when a grant is awarded in, probably realistically 2 years from now from the NIH, there's going to be, because you're already going to be needed to put this data into the public domain through the OSDP initiative, that data should go in there as, essentially a research object. So it has this community predefined set of criteria associated with it. So, and I sort of started to feel that alone would almost be like the second internet. It would be, suddenly we'd have, packets moving, we'd have some kind of communication and accessibility. People could start aggregating these things and doing amazing things with them just by virtue of these simple tags.
Thank you very much, Philip, again, for that wonderful talk. And we appreciate you coming here and highlighting that.